Estas welcome to episode one of Peachy and the Colonel. Peachy, welcome.
Hello. Thank you very much. Very excited about today.
Very.
Going to talk some shit.
Not that you couldn't be the Colonel. I don't think that's gender specific.
No, indeed. Absolutely. I could be the Colonel and you could be Peachy.
I could.
Yeah.
Good. I'm glad my parents didn't go in that direction, but they could have. They could have.
What is your favourite fruit?
My favourite fruit? Probably my most frequented fruit. Would be cantaloupe, I reckon.
That's interesting.
Tend to be able to find it all year round. I quite like the process of cutting it up and putting it in Tupperware.
Right. You find that quite a sort of mindful activity, do you?
Yes.
Yeah, great. Yes. Okay. So obviously we're here and this is episode one and we're going to talk some stuff and it's going to be a bit like that, a bit like what's your favourite fruit? And we want you guys to tell us what you want to know about and what you, the burning questions you have in a Seinfeldian kind of way. Yeah. The things that annoy you perhaps, like somebody's eyebrows. We want to know all about it. You can contribute.
Are you mentioning my eyebrows in particular or is someone else you're targeting?
Actually, that could be quite interesting just as an aside. But have you ever had anything waxed?
No. I think I had some wax strips at home that I sort of stuck on my arm and tested just to see what people go through.
Yeah, it's really a weird thing, but every other part of me being waxed I can handle, but something about my eyebrows makes me jump, like I leap off the bed. The beautician literally has to hold me down.
See, I would have thought your genitals would be far more sensitive
than your exactly what they say to me all the time. They're like, don't, you know, you can handle this. You can handle a Brazilian, but you can't handle your eyebrows. It's just weird.
It reminds me once of when I was trying to remove my hair from my genitals and I was too scared to wax and the idea of putting a blade near the fellas was... It was a bit scary, so I went for the depilatory wax, the cream. Sorry.
Oh,
and
did it make your balls smell like seaweed?
I must admit, I never can really get close enough to know what they smell like, unless it's
what a pity.
Unless it's a really bad day. No, I thought that would be the quickest and easiest way, and I thought I don't read instructions. I'm that sort of person.
Oh, no.
But I thought, what could possibly go wrong if I just leave it on? Like, if it says 8 minutes, I want to be thorough. I want all that hair gone. So I went for, 15, 20 minutes. I got sidetracked playing a computer game. And,
oh, my goodness.
By the time I got it off, a burning started.
Had it burned through a layer of skin by the time you took it off? Or?
Yeah, look, it didn't hurt at the time. It hurt when I started washing it off and then some sort of reaction happened where, things got terrible. And by the end, I was lying in bed. And for all those guys out there who could imagine the pain of putting ice upon your testicles, that's the only way I could stop the pain of the burning was to apply...
The lesser pain of the ice.
Yeah. I'll take it. So that's the last time I did that.
I must say, even if you'd followed the instructions with depilatory cream, the chance of it leaving you with some form of burning and or rash is just high anyway. Certainly my experience with depilatory cream has always been fairly horrendous.
Well, it's meant to be somewhat destructive. That's sort of the point, isn't it?
Oh, exactly. It's just burning hair follicles. It's not really
poison on you.
Exactly, yeah.
I wonder if those... those women who do the threading machine, I wonder if they do that to your testicles.
I wonder. I'm not sure. I reckon that the threading, because I've had it done once, but I wept so much because having it done on your eyebrows, it's more painful than waxing by far.
It makes
you
weep. At a time.
Yeah, exactly. But I imagine that it would catch the skin on your ball sack. I imagine that would be very uncomfortable.
Yeah, here we are digging into the big issues.
Exactly.
Yeah. Look, Peach, I sort of on topic. I watched a show last night called Lukewarm Sex. And strangely, I watched it on the recommendation of my mother, who I think is just as cringy and just as embarrassed about it all as Luke was.
Mm.
That is a fantastic show.
It's an interesting concept, isn't it? I mean, just the whole idea of an industry out there that's designed to get people comfortable enough with their own bodies that they can be comfortable with someone else's. It's sort of...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Look, I was just talking the other day about my world travels and talking about how beauty to me is all about what energy people give to me. So I remember when I went to Korea for the first time, I just thought everyone looked so sad and in a rush. And I thought, oh, Korean people aren't beautiful at all. But then once I got to know people, I went out drinking. All of a sudden I realized, you know, and they were smiling and laughing with me. I was like, oh, my God, these people are beautiful.
Mm.
And I thought, I came to the conclusion that it's smiling and that energy that makes you beautiful. And then that guy, Luke, in that show, he's the first person I've ever met who I think, don't smile, man.
No, I know. I know. He has such awful teeth, doesn't he? Very unfortunate.
It's so endearing, but when he really gets going and gets a giggle up, it's like his whole face opens up to this new level.
Yeah. But either way you look at it, a smile is transformational. It sort of reveals something about someone. Whether that's beautiful or not is debatable, especially in the case of him. But I think it's quite interesting how it sort of shows the true person in a way. And those people who have those cringy smiles or those half smiles, I'm quite suspicious of, I think, because I think, what are you not committing to being happy? Yeah. You know, just
what's
commit.
The other 10%?
Exactly, yeah. What isn't there, you know?
So maybe beauty's the wrong word. Maybe it's attractiveness. Maybe the fact that someone's smiling, you look at them and think, I want to get in on that.
Yeah.
I want to share in a bit of that positive energy.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it does help if they have straight white teeth. Yeah. It's very helpful.
Yes. Wonderful. That whole show, like I'm all for cringe comedy. I love The Office. And even the American spin-off, it wasn't quite on the same track but as the original, but oh.
Yeah,
that sort of comedy, it's new, it's fresh sort of comedy, and I love it. And then that show's kind of real. It takes it to a new level of reality where the guy's not trying to make you cringe. He's just trying to be.
And he's deeply cringing himself. I mean, that's what is so cringy about it. In that first episode when that woman was leaping on his abdomen, sort of pulsating on him for so long, and the poor man just wanted it so badly to be over, and he was so deeply uncomfortable. My toes were curled under on themselves, and I literally was throwing pillows at the TV because I just was so embarrassed for him and also appalled that he'd put himself in that situation and allowed a camera to be there, you know?
What was the situation for those who missed?
Oh, okay. So essentially the whole concept of the show is that this particular comedian, what is his name, Luke? What is it? I don't even know. I don't know. Oh, that's terrible, but I don't know. I can't remember. But he was for most of his life a virgin, and he wanted to work out sort of how to become more comfortable with the idea of sex so that he could have better sex when he did have it. And because he'd had a sort of series of, I guess, kind of clumsy sexual experiences which didn't kind of go the way he imagined they would. And what he essentially is doing over these couple of episodes is he's trying to learn more about how to be more comfortable with his own body and how to be more comfortable with someone else's body in order to, you know, have a more relaxed sexual experience. And he in the first episode, it was all essentially about just being close to women and normalizing that. So normalizing sort of having their hips near him and that sort of thing, and having their lips near him. So he set up a kissing booth in the middle of bloody South Bank. Appalling, absolutely amazing. And it was interesting, the people who would walk past sort of appalled at the idea that he'd kissed them, and then how many middle-aged women went up and approached him. I thought that was very, that was interesting in and of itself.
I think the older you get, the more you realise that your opportunities are limited.
Absolutely, and, yeah.
You lose your preciousness a bit.
Yeah, yeah.
It's Luke amazingly. McGregor, by the way.
Oh, okay, good. Yes, good.
Factual.
It's not. Yes, that's good. That's a good fact check. And was she like a sex therapist? She was, and her husband was looking on, and she essentially sat on him fully clothed, sort of straddled him the way you would if you were having sex, I guess, and kind of leapt up and down on his abdomen, kind of bounced up and down on her knees. And it was, I mean, he would have been there. We saw a truncated version, obviously, but he would have been there for at least half an hour being leapt on, having his diaphragm sort of, you know, beaten. And as one of my friends said last night at dinner, is there anything worse than going to a masseuse after you've had dal curry for lunch, you know, and just trying to have your sphincter closed? I just felt for him because I was like, if this guy's, you know, had anything to eat, he's just being leapt on. it's not going to be actually a very – and he was so deeply uncomfortable through the whole thing. He just looked – yeah.
I get the same feeling in Pilates. You're trying to get your core right, and it kind of helps because you're trying to suck everything in, so it kind of helps stop the expulsion of unwanted.
That's true, unwanted effluence. Air. Mm.
So that brings up an interesting question to me that I think we differ on. Like, where are you meant to find this stuff out? I guess there's constantly a discourse about the appropriateness of sex education in school. Is it the parents' responsibility? I know for me, I can't remember ever getting a sex talk from my parents. I remember one day my dad came in to tell us, he said, come into the lounge room, I'll tell you a trick about how to get rid of unwanted erections. And We all made such a, you know, made fun of it and laughed and snortled about it to the point where Dad cracked it and said, you know, stuff you, I'm not telling you. And to this very day, I still don't know the secret. And I assume you don't either.
Do you remember that? I'll never forget having a swimming lesson probably in year eight. And this boy being completely mortified by an unwanted erection on the side of the pool while we all swam past.
I tell you who never forgot it. Mm-hmm. That guy.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, exactly. He's in and all of the girls who witnessed it, I think.
So where are we meant to find out? I mean, there's this discourse at the moment about how kids are finding out about sex through pornography. Mm. It's the wrong way to learn. There's expectations on young girls to perform oral sex, anal sex, they're meant to be shaved, they're, you know, there's all this stuff that everyone's complaining about, but nobody's playing them a sex tape of healthy sex.
Yeah.
So where are they meant to find it? Like, let's acknowledge the fact that everyone watches, like every kid is going to come across porn.
Yeah.
I remember when I was like 14 or 15, my brother had I could tell plenty of stories about how my brother shaped the way I am, but he had a friend who brought over a video that had animals and all sorts of awful things.
Mm. Now, and that's true. I mean, I think this is important. Probably there's a more heightened exposure with the internet, and probably it's true that maybe younger kids are able to access it more easily than they could. But let's not kid ourselves. Those images and things were available to us and to the generation before through centerfolds, through video, through all of that. And this is not a new phenomena.
Yeah. Dick and balls have been drawn on caves for tens of thousands of years.
Exactly. Or rockets, as we call them, the rockets. The rockets which crop up everywhere. But I think there is probably maybe two parts to this. One is absolutely where does in which domain do we learn it, because it is certainly something we need to learn, and to be comfortable with the other gender is vital. And that's what that lukewarm sex thing is really, you know, stressing, that that's really important. But the other part of it is, you know, where do parental responsibilities start and finish? And how much of that do parents actually need to be told or have facilitated for them? Because I get the impression that, you know, just from your example there with your parents, like that was something they were deeply uncomfortable with. So they weren't sure how to tackle that maybe. And, you know, what do we rely on? The Life Education Caravan, you know, I mean, I don't, and that's still going around. Harold the giraffe is still around. Yeah,
you don't want to learn how to have sex from a giraffe.
That's true.
I'm sure there's logistical
issues. Chris, I have to say, you know, in terms of setting up expectations for long penises, it's not a bad thing, you know.
Something phallic about a giraffe.
It's absolutely, fundamentally. Mm. but I think that there are two parts, and I think, you know, it would be interesting to hear from some parents about how they feel about where this might be best discussed, because I also think the issue with it being put back on schools is that finding out about this stuff with your peers probably makes you respond to it in a slightly different way than you do if you're hearing it from adults in a sort of more solitary scenario or a more one-on-one environment. 'Cause I think, you know, I just remember when we were taught, you know, when we got to play with condoms and put them on a carrot or whatever we did, most of us just blew them up and we're a bit ridiculous about it. I'm not sure
and
how
carrots
much.
Carrots don't go soft when they're not nervous.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, fundamentally, there's those sort of things were not discussed. This is where maybe single sex education has something on the co-ed, because we were all so embarrassed together that maybe that was the issue. But I also, you know, when I actually came to needing to put on a condom, that carrot instruction really hadn't helped me. You know, the actual logistics of that were way harder than I expected them to be, you know.
And I think the basics. It's important that the basics are there. But, I mean, you're not gonna put one on your son or something. I mean, there's kind of a line where practical on-the-job training isn't really appropriate.
Mm.
And honestly, for me, some of the best things about sex are the mystery of it. Like, you know, I read a fair bit of stuff on Reddit. Mm. And one of the communities I quite like to be involved with is the sex subreddit. And it's a very sex positive sort of place. And I don't know, it's probably not a reflection of the general populace in a lot of ways. One thing I like about it is just that it's a totally open forum. Any question can be asked, and it's asked anonymously. Mm. So there's plenty of people asking really silly questions. You know, my girlfriend's on birth control. Do I still need to wear a condom? And I don't know, like. It seems like they're asking the minute, but they haven't been taught. Like, a condom's not going to stop transferring an STI, for example. So it depends what your purpose is. Anyway, I digress.
No, but I think that is interesting because that, you know, for all of the time that people spend talking about the evils of the internet, that's where it is a really fantastic forum because it can be anonymous and because you can ask anything and that's good. But that's also what then, you know, the whole trolls thing is kind of interesting too, but that's probably a topic for another day. But, you know, this thing of isn't it good to be anonymous when you want to ask a question that you might feel silly asking otherwise? It also is interesting to what extent people still rely on their family doctor for this information. Like, I don't know that people go to GPs and ask these questions anymore because you've got 15 minutes and you're paying $80. Like, you really do just go in and it's become like a much more functional transaction than I think it probably is set up to be. I think in a way your best GPs are the ones who do have a chat with you and actually talk you through the whole process rather than just, sign you up for the script for birth control send you on your merry way. And I think that is what's interesting and possibly what's missing. I mean, we did get a lot of that information at school, but I think the part of the issue is that you're only given bits of it. You're not kind of necessarily, there's a lot of there's a lot of fear, you know, that's built into that education.
And it seems that a lot of things, like, you know, we talk about bullying a lot in schools, and you're taught practical skills about how to handle it when you're being bullied, the process of walking away, the process of this and that. I don't see much of that practical stuff going on with, you know, for example, what if a guy's pressuring you or a girl's pressuring you into doing something you're not comfortable with?
What do you say?
And how do you deal with the social ramifications after that when you're being called a prude or you're being called a slut or, you know, any of these kind of slurs? I remember sex education at school being, this is an ovary, this is a fallopian tube. That hasn't really helped my sex life, to be honest. I've never really come across a fallopian tube.
Nobody showed you the clitoris, you know. Nobody showed you the clitoris. It just doesn't happen. And nobody explains to you that the vagina actually isn't, you know.
Isn't the vulva.
Exactly. And, yeah. Like, you know, like all that. Mind you, I guess they do that in year 11 biology. But, I stopped science early, so I never saw any of that. But I think it is interesting that, and I think it has changed. I mean, I think what the kids learn is probably a little bit more practical. But in terms of actually what you say and do when you're being, as you say, like sort of socially outcast or insulted for a choice you've made, I think that still plagues people. Going back to this trolling idea, I was at this writing workshop on the weekend, and the presenter was talking about how one of her writer friends had just got through her first episode of trolling after being published. And she explained it as actually almost like a sort of awful internet bullying rite of passage that sort of has to happen for women who go online, who have to be prepared to be absolutely abused and vilified, using like highly sexually connotative language. And I just wonder to what extent that's, fair or okay, or, you know, maybe those practical things are just as relevant for, older people as they are for younger people. We all need to know about how to, I guess, when to ignore and when to defend, you know. That's an interesting idea.
I think I learned in my life that there's lots of people around me all the time telling me I'm a dickhead. And there's lots of people around me all the time patting my back. And what I came to realize is that I don't listen to a lot of people who call me a dickhead. And also I don't listen to a lot of people who pat me on the back and tell me I'm good. You choose. You choose who you are going to let define you. So at the end of the day, you're choosing what you want to hear and what you want to believe. And I think that sort of resilience, you know, I'd like to think in my life there's nothing you could say to me right now that would make me cry.
Oh, I'd love to. What a challenge.
And I'm sure that's really asking for it from the trollers. I'm sure you, yeah. But that sort of resilience is like, you know, if you know, you hear a lot of comedians talk about the fact that they just don't read reviews until their show's over. Because what's the point? You've already done all the work. You've done something. The people who are critiquing you haven't. You've already done it. So what's the point of listening to it? You're not going to change your act. You're not going to drop your joke about the toadstool or, you know.
But it's interesting because it is that increasingly, I think you do hear from a lot of people for whom, even if they wanted to choose, they're so anxious or so full of self-doubt that it becomes the only thing they can hear is the negative stuff. And that was, you know, that came out a lot in this. I mean, look, we're all the sort of woulda, coulda, shoulda kind of writers sitting in this writing workshop, but there was, you know, one particular person who'd been published, and they were saying that all they could remember were the negative reviews and they just kept replaying in their head. And the awards, all the good feedback, none of that had sort of mattered because they were going through a particular period of writer's block, and so they were just looking at ways to sort of whip themselves with that negative thing. And yes, it is a choice, but, you know, I don't know whether we're increasingly pathologizing ourselves or whether it's just I'm more aware of it, but there just seem to be, and particularly, there just seem to be a lot, the the levels of anxiety in sort of like the 30-somethings seems to be very high. I don't know whether that's like a midlife thing, whether you become more unsure the more you realize that you – somebody said to me the other day, it's because you can actually – you start to see your life stretching out before you and you realize that not much will change.
Yeah.
And that generates a sort of anxiety. I'm not sure if that's true.
You realize the patterns about life.
Yeah.
I think also I remember being a school kid and having the flu, for example, and I'd come to school and I'd be achy and sore. But if there was a basketball game on, I'd start playing. And after a while, I'd feel okay. And then I'd cool down a bit and I'd feel pretty shitty again. But I didn't have a name for that. So when it happened, I wasn't referencing it against other times. The older you get, it's like, oh, this is a particularly bad flu this year.
Ah, yes, yeah.
And I think the more we name things in life and give it an identity, all of a sudden it has a power over us. It's like...
Because we've identified a pattern.
Yeah.
And then once you identify a pattern, you expect it to repeat. That's the worst bit, isn't it? Yeah.
And the anxiety. It's like you recognize a time in your life when you had a really comfy couch, you had great friends around you, the lighting was just right, the temperature was right, and you were having a good time. And then the next time you catch up with someone and, you know, your chair's not so comfortable or something, you notice it because you're comparing it to the other times. And I think anxiety comes from that thing about wanting to control everything and wanting it to always be...
As it was, that great place.
Mm. Whereas creativity is the exact opposite. Creativity comes from where you take what you get and you work within the box and you work to push out from the box. And that's where most of the joys in life come from. It doesn't come from when you're comfortable. It comes from when you've got some weird situation that you battle your way out of and you get this great sense of triumph and success from it.
So much about that is... there's such a synergy between problem solving and creativity. And that's, you know, increasingly I think as well, and I don't know whether this was something we were told so much, but kids seem to be told that you're either a right brain person or a left brain person and, you know, never the twain shall meet. And I don't know that that's very helpful because I think that sets you up as well to believe that there's things you're maybe not as good at or you can't do. And that's... not really true. We've all got, you know, a mind and that we can put to work. I'm not saying we don't have attributes and strengths, sure, and maybe we have things that we lean towards one side or the other. But I just, you know, I see people dismiss things before they've begun and it's people who are our age because they've got that set idea of what they can or can't do, you know, and because of those patterns or because of what they've been told or because of what they've experienced. It's have you ever done the escape room thing?
Yes, yeah. Many times. Big time.
I just love it. And part of what I found so exciting, and for those of you who haven't done it, get onto escaperoom.com.au and go and try it. It's the most fabulous, like, psychological experiment. And also, like, team building kind of activity if you want it to be a team building activity. But tell us about the basic concept, Chris.
You get locked in a room. Well, you're not locked in a room. Oh. You can leave whenever you want. You can leave whenever you want, but the idea is that you've got to solve a series of puzzles to get out of the room. It sometimes involves some maths puzzles, sometimes involves some like colours, combinations, anything. Some of them are really kinetic and they've all got a different flavour. Some of them are really professional. Others you turn up and go out the back of someone's mum's place. And they're sometimes the best ones too.
But they've all got like a theme and a sort of overriding loose narrative that you kind of follow, which you soon forget about when you're in the depths of solving problems and things. But the whole thing has been set up by psychology students. So it's interesting the way you're guided through the problem. And if you sort of run into trouble, you can sort of talk to the room and it talks back to you, which is an interesting idea. But one of the things... and my first one that the guy said to me is, because I said, I'm not a good problem solver. You know, I'm not a maths person. I can't do this. And he said, you'll be surprised. Like, just let that concept go and embrace the story and you'll be, you know, just embrace the scenario and you'll be fine. And it's true because what I brought to that room was so different to what, you know, my friends, brought to the room, and it was such an exhilarating thing because we were just combining brains on so many levels, you know. I think it's quite an interesting, and it was quite an affirming kind of thing to do because you're not often put in a scenario where you're asked to sort of do those problem-solving activities unless you're an engineer or somebody who's doing it all the time. You know, it was exciting to put myself in that new environment and use my brain in a different way.
Yeah, and together, like, do something social that actually challenges you a bit. I've done probably four or five different escape rooms and with all different groups of people, some of them good buddies. One of them I did with my partner. So there were three Taiwanese doctors and one Taiwanese accountant. They were all super smart, really quick with the maths and the puzzles. And they all spoke in Chinese, which really didn't help me at the time. But there were things that I did. You know, there was some puzzle where you actually had to look out the window and see for a long way. None of them have good eyesight, but I do.
There's an attribute you didn't even know you had. There you go. Yeah, exactly.
Right. Yep. I'm tall. I can see, you know, I can see higher. But I just love that fact. Like, nobody goes in there feeling like you're the captain or, you know, it's just all in.
And I remember you saying something about it being quite a refreshing activity because it's the one thing you do where you don't drink or you don't, you know, you're not reliant on those sort of social crutches. You're not sharing a meal or sharing a drink. You're actually sharing an activity, which is a rarity unless you're in a structured activity nowadays, you know, for
Absolutely.
Us.
Absolutely. If you're trying to lose weight or stay sober, a lot of people I see, they just go into hermit mode because what are you going to do? Like, where do you meet up where you're not going to have something to eat or be in the pub or something? I'm sure there are people who have good answers to this, and I'd love to hear them.
Absolutely.
Your hot tips
for hermitless weight loss, yes.
For me, you know, it was frisbee. You know, catch up with someone in a park, chuck a frisbee for half an hour, have a chat, and then go. And often that turns into, you know, bringing an esky to the park and having a beer while you throw the frisbee. But, you know, I thought the escape rooms were fantastic like that, and also were fantastic for my partner to meet people because it's like playing board games with someone or Pictionary or something. It's a really good way. Like, you can have a really deep relationship, working relationship with someone in Pictionary that you don't really have outside of that environment.
That's quite true, isn't it?
And whereas you can have a married couple playing Pictionary who nearly kill each other.
Yeah.
It's a tree, god damn it. It's obviously a tree. I find that really, really interesting.
Yep, absolutely. I think you often hear about escape room being used as a sort of date tool. And I think it would be quite an interesting way of getting to know that person in a very different context.
Oh, nothing
than
like
the
locking
bar.
Someone in a room.
Absolutely, and seeing what they do, seeing if they freak out or become helpless. I mean, I think that would be very indicative of the sort of things that they would do in a unfamiliar scenario in real life.
Yeah.
You know?
The first one I did was they actually blindfolded you and marched you into the room. And when they took off the blindfold, the door slams and it's pitch black.
Oh, God.
And it was a tiny little room and there was four of us and it was quite hot. And I think it was quite deliberate. Like, the room, as you got more and more excited or, you know, got into it, the room was just getting hotter and hotter. Like, the panic just naturally built and everyone starts getting smelly and, you know.
Yeah. Oh, it's a definite adrenaline rush, even though you know it's a sort of structured activity that you're doing. It's like when
you don't
see
want to be
people,
stupid.
Exactly. And it's like, you know, when you're playing a board game and people's competitiveness really comes out, you know, people's desire to win or to like meet the challenge becomes overarching, you know.
Yeah. I don't want to come out and say, oh, yeah, we nearly won. What did everyone else do? Oh, 97% of people get out of the room in the first 20 minutes. No one wants to know where they fit in terms of humanity's stupidity.
It's true. It's a little bit like, you know, how there's been this real backlash against IQ, IQ scores. And I think it's probably because most of us realize we don't fit into the genius category.
This is what stupid people say.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I hate IQ tests. They don't say anything about it.
I have very high EQ,
I like the internet ones that you do because I usually get around like 130, 140. And I'm like, that's what I want to hear.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I'd like to. No, I don't want to sign up for your newsletter, but you can just keep telling me I'm smart.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, it's so reliable, the internet IQ test. Deeply, fundamentally.
So that's a good question to pose, actually. What do you do with people, with your friends, other than drink coffee, drink booze, or eat food?
Yeah.
Board games has become something for me, especially as your friends start getting pregnant. All of a sudden, you've got to provide an opportunity that's entertaining if you're not, if you're sober. And, that general just sitting around talking rubbish doesn't really cut it for a lot of sober people.
Although we're doing a good job of it here right now, aren't we?
Yeah. Yeah, I might have slipped something in your coffee.
Yeah.
I don't know. We do have this magnificent cookie here that's fueling us too. I don't know what's in it, but it's giant and it's multicolored and it's really good. That's probably all the mouth noises you've been hearing from my microphone. Setting a professional tone.
Yes, exactly.
What other things do you do?
I mean, apart from sharing, like going for a walk or something, and that is great debrief time with friends. I really enjoy that debrief time.
I love it too, but it's a tough sell.
It's exactly.
Oh, I want to drive around to my place and we'll walk around the block.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a tough sell, but once you're doing it, I'd actually probably prefer doing it.
You think, this is quite pleasant. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it is also like a weather permitting type of thing, which is what is good about the board games is it can be, the evening or, But I'm not convinced that, I'm not convinced that all of these things aren't enhanced by alcohol. As you say, the esky with the beer makes the frisbee funner, I think, probably,
See,
a quiet gin and tonic with your mahjong isn't a bad thing either.
See, my partner just doesn't have that option. If she drinks, she falls asleep. So I watch her play board games with me and my friends and as we drink more, I just watch her intolerance for us grow. And it highlights just how stupid you become.
Oh, and how boring. I mean, I think that's the thing. When you if you've ever done Feb Fast or anything like that, when you go out with your friends, it's horrendous. Mm. It's like, I didn't realize my friends were so boring and belligerent and stupid,
Repetitive.
Exactly, yeah. And I'm sure that everybody who's ever been pregnant will tell you the same thing.
I mean, that's kind of the beauty of alcohol, and I guess its popularity is it's the most social of all drugs. I mean, there's all sorts of substances out there, but alcohol seems to be the one that actually brings people together and makes people enjoy each other.
Mm.
Whereas a lot of other substances, that's to say, I'm sure things like ecstasy have a similar thing, but you can't take ecstasy and go out to the yacht club with your mum for lunch.
But at the same time, the flip side of it is something deeply antisocial. There's nothing more disturbing than there are some fully blown alcoholics in my family, and there's nothing more disturbing than like a 9 a.m. drunk, just in terms of totally ruining your expectations of, breakfast.
Yeah.
I don't think I ever, it's funny. As a young person, I don't think I ever imagined that any of my friends would become substance addicted, including to alcohol. And there's just something so kind of awful or confronting about that, because you do just think as a young person when you're coming to try these things, you do see them for the sort of social aspect or the fun aspect.
Mm.
You never imagine yourself, I mean, I guess it's like with anything, you never imagine yourself on the bad end of it.
Yeah.
Although talking to one of my friends this morning, she was saying, I just didn't think I'd be alive past 35. I'm not quite sure what to do now, and it's true. Like sometimes you do imagine yourself having a sort of short, sharp life and when you don't, that can be equally as strange.
I think with substance abuse, it's kind of, I mean, it's why, you know, I'm known to do my little sabbaticals. I take sort of a month, 2 months, 3 months off, off drinking, off and off meat, off anything that I think I question whether or not I could ever stop. And the only reason I do it is because unless you try and stop, how do you know if you can or not? Like everyone says, oh, I don't need alcohol, or, you know, you hear so many people, I don't need to smoke, I just love to smoke.
Mm.
It's kind of like, well, but that is it. Like if you can't stop and you can't prove it by at least, you know, I don't really agree with the Feb fast thing, you know, people posting on Facebook about how amazing it is that it's been 4 days since you had a drink. It's like, that's actually pretty pathetic to me. Great that you're raising money for charity. That's terrific. But it's the one time when a lot of people actually try and find out just how difficult it is. And if it's difficult, then you got a problem.
Yeah, like somebody I know was just saying last night that they set themselves the goal of not drinking for a year and that they lasted 6 weeks. And I said, well, 6 weeks is still brilliant. You know, that's still pretty good. But the problem is, and this is the thing, maybe this is the issue, is that we set ourselves, you know, this is coming back to this writing workshop, you know, your goal is too big. Like you can't sit down and say, I'm going to write the next great Australian novel. You just have to sit down and say, I'm going to write and see what happens. You know, like it's just, it's also, you know, it's just setting yourself up for failure a bit, you know, if you make it too big. So I think that's where FebFast is good, because it's got a clear kind of beginning and end game to it.
And there's a community, right?
Exactly,
there's other people going through it. That really helps.
Yeah.
I always had a thing whenever I did my wacky sabbaticals, and, you know, the first few were just, I'm not going to smoke or drink for a month. And I draw up a little chart in my room and tick off every day that I didn't, just so that there was some sort of celebration and sense of achievement. But what I did differently to a lot of people is that when my friends went to the pub for a drink and a smoke, I went to the pub and I exercised my willpower actively. Like there's no, I don't see any point in hiding away from it. But if you can sit on a table while other people are smoking and drinking and you have a big pint of soda water with a squeeze of lime, or, you know, something which costs just as much as a beer, which is the ridiculous thing, I could sit there quite happily. And in fact, the fact that I was exercising my willpower made me feel better. Made me feel tons better than sitting at home going, oh, geez, I wish I could go to the pub and hang with my friends.
Because it would also make you, it also makes you resent your choice not to have those things if you then hermit yourself, you know, if you then, hide away. And but honestly, I think you're very good at that, Chris, like exercising your willpower. You're very good at that. I'm not as solid like that. I go through phases where I can be, but, and I, you know, the other day my trainer asked me, what's your real struggle with food? And I just said to him, well, I like it. Like I really like eating. I really enjoy it. I really, you know, and that's the same thing. I really enjoy a glass of wine. So it really feels like this sacrifice, you know, I feel like I'm, and so even if I'm sitting there drinking soda water, I find it hard not to, you know, long for that glass of Pinot, you know, that's sitting in front of me that someone else is having, you know.
I don't know. Like at the moment I'm not eating meat, for example, and
good environmental choice.
Yeah, look, there's so many things about it. I've been listening to these, you know, a lot of podcasts about veganism and its impacts on the environment and all of that. And you know, I'm not going to preach, because that's not why I'm doing it. I'm doing it because when I eat meat, I get fat, and when I stop eating it, I get skinny.
Yeah,
and it's, you know, nothing tastes as good as skinny feels and all that, you know, all that rubbish. It's not really true for me, but it's a willpower thing. It's like, you know, last night I cooked roast veggies and some mushrooms with feta, and my partner cooked a big ribeye on the bone. And, you know, I love a ribeye on the bone, but I don't know. The longer I do it, the longer I've been without meat, the better I feel physically, and then the better I feel mentally. And when I go to a restaurant or a cafe and I look at the menu, I don't go straight for the burger section. I don't go straight for the steak section, which I just can't help. They're the things that jump out at me. Mm. Whereas now, on your recommendation yesterday, I had some kingfish, raw
kingfish. Did you
kingfish,
like it?
Cured kingfish. Fantastic.
Yeah, never Miss Columbia's in Albert Park. Go and eat raw fish for breakfast.
Beautiful. So, you know, the longer I do it, the more I realize I wouldn't have done that if I was eating meat.
Mm.
Not because I don't like it, just because I would never consider it. So now when I look at the menu, I'm like, all right, so what's in the fish? What's in the veggies? Mm. You know, a grilled eggplant parma instead of a chicken one. It's different, and you actually get this great variety of food. And, you know, for me in life, I get bored of everything quickly. So I guess opening up those channels that give me greater variety, that's what I'm after.
Mm.
And that stopping eating meat does that for me. Mm. Stopping drinking alcohol does the same thing. It makes me start thinking about what activities I could do other than just going to the pub.
Yeah, definitely. We were talking about this last night about, on Tuesday night, a friend of mine who's been a vegetarian and essentially a vegan for most of her life, she tried beef with me for the first time on Tuesday night.
Wow.
Because she's developed such a terrible kind of allergic response to so many different plant-based proteins that she now is just like so hungry and so exhausted all of the time.
Wow.
And she can't have any grains. So, you know, all of those protein powders or dairy. So all of those protein powders, they've all got, you know, they're like brown rice based or pea based or, you know, so that's not an option. And we started talking about, you know, because she's also studying psychology, about cognitive dissonance and this thing where you can, on one hand, believe very strongly in, you know, protecting animals by not eating them and by respecting animals by not eating them versus the kind of brutal natural reality of being hungry and needing protein and suddenly seeing meat sort of as a carnivorous creature, which is what we are, you know. Yeah. It's quite an interesting
part of our evolution as a species.
Yeah,
too.
And she's really struggling with that now because, you know, she said it's not that I'm going to go eat a whole cow, but I do feel like my little need here is now contributing to this kind of wider environmental issue in terms of methane gases released and, you know, erosion and all of that sort of stuff. So whether or not, I mean, as you say, you're coming at it from a weight loss perspective, but it is interesting to think about, you know, those of us who are eating meat all the time probably need the balance of flipping it back the other way. And those of us who are never eating meat may need digestively the balance of having it, you know, occasionally.
Interestingly, you can get proteins from plants and that's fine, but the way that the protein molecules are in plants is really different to how they line up in animals. So, you know, it's like vitamins. You can take a vitamin supplement, but it doesn't necessarily get absorbed into your body unless you have the right precursors. You know, if you eat spinach, you should put some lemon on it. So the vitamin C helps you convert the iron from the spinach. And there's tons of examples like that. And vegetarians, vegans have real trouble getting things like B12. And getting the right sorts of proteins to actually activate in their bodies. So, look, I don't think anyone likes to believe in, you know, in factory farming or anything. But likewise, you know, when's the last time you had the opportunity to go kill your own cow, cut it up and...
And even if I did have the opportunity, I wouldn't want it. I mean, I have no doubt that a visit to the abattoir would mean that I would never eat meat again. I mean, I have no doubt.
Yeah, they said that about working in the Coles deli when I was 16, but it just made me eat more meat, to be honest.
Did it make you appreciate, but the thing is that I do think it makes you appreciate that biodynamic approach or organic approach to farming. You know, I do feel much much happier, much less guilt about eating a happy chicken and having paid like triple for it, but at least I know it was happy. Do you know what I mean? But what we're now seeing with that whole, like, you know, free-range egg thing on Facebook that's going around at the moment is that, you know, we might be paying a lot of money for free-range eggs so that we all feel happy in our middle-class, contented world, urban world, where we're not even seeing the hens.
Mm.
We might be happy about that free-range choice and paying a lot of money for it, but we don't actually know what we're eating. And free-range is not actually free-range anymore. Yeah. What we need is pasture-fed or something, pasture-free.
It really comes down to where you get your information from as well. Mm-hmm. Like that free range, like there's some legislation that says this is what free range means. Do you look into what it actually means? Like if a farmer wants that sticker, he's going to do the bare minimum in terms of the economics. Like he's trying to make money. He's not trying to make friends with his chickens. Mm. He's going to do the bare minimum. So what's the bare minimum, right? They need, you know, 2 hours of sunshine and they need at least 50 square centimetres each or something. Like it's not rainbows and lollipops. Mm. And it's the same thing with vegans having this sort of thou shalt not kill attitude. I mean, the fact is farmers of vegetables, they still kill things. They kill insects. They kill animals that are eating the vegetables. Like things are still dying for you to get your food, whether you're killing it or not. And that's just a reality of life. If, you know, I've been
fishing.
But is
that just because of mass food production? I mean, I would like rainbows and lollipops though, Chris. Can't we have it?
Yeah. Oh. It's a lovely idea. But it's like being in the ocean fishing. You know, I love game fishing. You nearly catch a fish and you nearly get it in the boat. And then some other fish twice its size eats it. I mean, it's not like if you didn't catch that fish, it was going to live a long, happy life. Like, it's nature.
Mm.
Like, shit happens all the time in nature. Everything's trying to eat everything. It's bloody. It's brutal. Mm.
But the problem is that we've developed so much, so many systems around that, that so much of what I guess we're consuming is this hygienically packaged, perfectly labelled, well-presented piece of, you know, spinach in a bag, perfectly washed, ready to go, that we forget that there could be a problem in that process where it develops salmonella or where, you know, like we had, you know, not long ago. That I just think it's the cognitive dissonance thing.
Mm.
You know, there is a disconnect between what we actually do and what we sort of stand for.
Yeah.
And that's an interesting, I think it would be interesting to hear from people who sort of do put their money where their mouth is in all sorts of ways.
Gardening at home.
Yeah, exactly. Or that, you know, that whole permaculture movement, you know, what is possible. I'm always amazed by what's possible in my tiny little courtyard. But I'm also amazed on the flip side of that by how expensive that is. I mean, ultimately, yes, it's lovely to have my own tomatoes, but when I think about the amount of sort of inefficient watering and feeding I'm doing of those plants.
Yeah, and then it comes down to how do you do it more efficiently?
Mm,
you know, there's ways you can catch your rainwater, you can you can put it in tanks, you can set up your vertical garden so it trickles down and the water from the top one ends up getting down.
Mm.
There's lots of ways, but unless, you know, unless you're constantly doing it and trying to get better, like there's no innovation happening. It's going to stay the same.
Mm. We were talking too about setting up your own hive at home, you know, for bees.
Mm.
And
your neighbours would love that.
Yeah, well, I actually thought it would be a much simpler process than it is, but bees are very pernickety about what they're happy to, you know, where they're where they're
could
happy
you just
to
define
live.
That for people like me?
Oh, you know, you know, specific. Yeah. They're very picky.
Finicky.
Yeah, exactly. Finicky. It's like a version of both of those put together. I don't know. I don't even know if it's real. It's a real word. But they really do have very specific requirements, and the potential for them to swarm over the smallest thing is very high, really. You do have to probably have a large enough yard that you can have those bees far enough away from your house for it to not be problematic. Yeah. And that was, for me, that was the real issue was, you know, I guess that's why so many people put them on their roof. So that seems to be quite a good place in terms of keeping them kind of away from, you know, your garden. If you've got a family or whatever, you don't want people.
They need to be near flowers and trees and, you know, that.
And you have to set up your garden so that you constantly have flowers in bloom, which is actually quite difficult to do. I mean, you have to be quite, you know, systematic about that as a gardener to make sure that they're giving you what they want. But interestingly as well, they drown bees. So you need to set up, like, you need to always have a source of water close to their hive, and you have to have little platforms so that they can sit on the platform and then dip their little heads into the water without drowning. And I've had all these bees in my garden around, like, the moss around the pond, and I thought they liked the moss. I thought it was like they were getting some sort of pollination deal out of the moss, which I thought was weird because it doesn't flower.
Just tickling their undersides.
I don't know. But then I realised, no, they're using it as a little ledge to get to the water.
Yeah.
And in, I guess, thanks for their water, they've also now pollinated my orange tree for the first time. I have an orange. I'm very excited.
A whole orange?
A whole orange. Wow. It's still green, but it's growing. And it's still. Let's hope it gets to ripening point before the birds attack it. I don't know. Hmm.
Yeah, very cool. There's so much there. I just inherited a stand-up garden bed, a tumble compost bin, and a worm farm, a well-established worm farm.
How excellent.
Which, I'm the perfect person for a worm farm because I eat so many vegetables every day and such a variety that, you know, every day or two I have a full compost load to go out.
It is quite amazing how much waste is created when you only eat veggies. I'm really
it's not waste when it all goes back into the land.
Exactly, yeah.
Like, it's not a plastic bag that's going to stay a plastic bag forever. It's you know,
but I guess when
worm
you're
poo that goes
eating those that much vegetable, you do realize that you probably need that. You'd actually need a worm farm or a compost bin or something to make it, you know, not just more landfill.
But at least same with landfill, at least it turns back to dirt.
That's true.
You know, it's not your footprint. I just find it hilarious going to the supermarket and seeing, you know, like a banana in a case, or, you know, all these vegetables that have their own natural packaging and they take it off, like corn, they strip its natural packaging and then cover
it in plastic.
I know. It doesn't make any sense.
No.
It doesn't make any sense.
It's true. Now, I've heard, though, that the tumbling compost bins are no good.
Is that right?
Yeah, because apparently if they're not on the ground, then when it gets quite hot, the worms can't go back into the soil and sort of retreat. So it ends up killing the worms.
Well, I think you need to store it like potatoes. It needs to be
in the dark,
undercover and in the dark.
But then does it get hot enough to create compost?
I think compost. The funny thing I learned about the worms is the worms don't eat the vegetables. The worms eat the microbes and the bacteria that are eating the vegetables and decomposing it. So I don't know. There's all that you've got to keep it moist enough to decompose, but dry enough so that the things don't drown. It's really specific. Well, when I say specific, there's a big booklet, and
is it pernickety, Chris?
It's rather pernickety.
Excellent.
I read through it. And I really don't know what I'm doing. But when I got the worm farm, I'd open the lid and there'd be a few worms. And now when I open the worm farm, there's like, they're everywhere.
How fantastic.
And, you know, every now and then I think, should I do something? So I chuck some newspaper in, or I chuck a bit of lime in or something. But
do you ever just transfer the worms into the garden to do their thing?
No, so you collect their waste.
It goes, which is good fertilizer, yeah?
Yeah, it's like the best fertilizer, and then you mix it with water and mix it through your soil. I don't actually have my garden bed set up yet, so.
How's your pizza oven going?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm hoping to get some concrete delivered tomorrow, and then I've got the top slab, then I can start building the next bit. And
we'd love to hear from people who are doing their little DIY projects in the backyard, particularly from those of you who maybe haven't finished and would like some motivation for finishing.
And look, you know, for me, you touched on this before, how many of the things you do from day to day, week to week, are actually connected to your survival? Like, we're not connected with our food supply. We're not connected to our water supply. everything's removed. Like the only thing we do that's particularly natural is we take a shit every day, you know, and that's a rather bleak look at life. But I think that's why I want to build a pizza oven. I want to make my own fire and cook my food in it. I want to grow my own vegetables so that I can appreciate my vegetables a bit more. Like I like the idea of, I like the idea that when the zombies come and there's an apocalypse and we resettle, I'll have some skills where, you know.
I didn't know the zombies were coming. Are they coming?
Oh, they're coming.
I see.
They're coming, all right. Peachy, look, that's our hour.
Oh, that was easy.
That went very quickly, and we didn't cover any of the topics that we wrote down on our list.
Excellent.
So that means we've got plenty for next episode. Mm. Please get in touch with us. We'd love to hear your thoughts on all the jibber-jabber we spoke about. And if you have any of those burning little questions about life that you'd like answered or avoided in our next podcast, feel free to chuck them our way.
Yeah, we may just create more questions than answers, but we'll do our best. The other thing is that we're, you know, going to start bringing on some guests. So if you've got some suggestions for people you'd like to hear from, we'd love to hear that as well.
You're bored of me already, Peach.
No, it's just good to have another voice.
Great. Well, thanks for being with us for episode one of Peachy and the Colonel. We will be back very soon, and, great to be chatting with you.